My name's Aggie Branchig. I've met a lot of you already, but in case you don't know. And I'll be giving the front-end quantum mechanics course. So this course is going to review some fundamental concepts in quantum mechanics. And there's a lot of material to cover, so I'm going to touch on each topic rather briefly. And I'm going to work under the assumption that most of you have seen most of this material already. In particular, the first two lectures, which are on the Schrödinger equation. So just to get a rough idea, how many of you guys have done at least three semesters of quantum mechanics? Yeah, okay. And two? One? Yeah, so pretty sure that most of the stuff in the first two lectures you've seen, but it's good to review it again, and it's good for everybody to be on the same page when we start the later courses. So no course in quantum mechanics is complete with an introduction to linear algebra, but since Anna Kostucki did a very nice introduction in her algebra course a couple of weeks ago, I'm not going to really talk about it here. And so I've made a set of notes, so I'll give them to you in the next couple of days once I tidy them up. So don't feel that you have to write everything down if you're the type of person that listens better without writing down, feel free not to do that. If, on the other hand, you prefer to write things down, if that's how your brain works, then you're welcome to do that as well, up to you. And please feel free to interrupt and ask questions. As Tibor said, he might not be able to answer all of them, and I might also not be able to answer all of them, but perhaps somebody else in the class will be able to do that, and it'll at least inspire some discussion. Okay, so we'll begin this lecture with a discussion of the wave function, which is a very important concept in quantum mechanics. And as a precursor to this, let's just for a moment consider what happens in classical mechanics. So let's say we have a particle of mass m, and this particle is constrained to the x direction, and it has some sort of force applied to it, f of xt. And so in classical mechanics, we're interested in determining this particle's position as a function of time. And then once we get this, we can determine other interesting dynamical variables. For example, the velocity, or momentum, or kinetic energy, or anything else you might be interested in. So let's say classical mechanics. And so how do we get x of t in the first place? Well, we use Newton's second law. And we use the fact that for conservative systems, the force can be expressed as the derivative of the potential. And then we can write Newton's second law like this. And now, with appropriate boundary conditions and initial conditions, we can solve this differential equation and figure out x. So this is the classical program. But now let's look at quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, it doesn't make sense anymore to talk about a definite position of a particle. We'll come to the reasons for that later on in the course. But instead, what we like to talk about is the particle's wave function. And this wave function is going to be a function of the position x and the time t. And so what exactly is this wave function, and how can we use it to represent the state of a particle, something that we're used to thinking about as having, you know, a definite position and a definite at a definite time? Yeah, so thanks to Max Born, we've got a nice statistical interpretation of this wave function. So. And that says that the probability is going to be given by psi of x of t squared. And to be more precise, the probability of finding a particle between A and B is going to be given by the integral over x from A to B. And so if we draw, let's say, an example wave function for a particular particle, it might look something like this. We can see that the probability is just going to be given by the area under this curve from A to B. And for this particular wave function, we're very likely to find the particle somewhere here, let's say at position A, and we're quite unlikely to find the particle here at position B. And so this type of picture introduces some rather uncomfortable philosophical issues related to determinacy. So Newtonian mechanics is deterministic in the sense that given a set of given a way to specify the state of a particle, we can predict its position, its velocity, and everything like that. But in quantum mechanics, everything that you know about a particle is encoded in its wave function. And even if you know the wave function very accurately, you still can't predict the outcomes of measurements in quantum mechanics. So you won't be able to predict even a simple measurement like measuring the position of a particle. So the question is this indeterminism a fact of nature, or is it just a flaw of the theory of quantum mechanics? And how you answer this question really just depends on your personal interpretations of the theory of quantum mechanics. So there are quite a few different interpretational theories out there. Just to list a few, there's realism, which was Einstein's interpretation of choice, the Copenhagen interpretation, many worlds, de Broglie, Bohm theory. And we're not really going to talk about these in detail in this course, but the general gist of it is that if you think that the particle actually has a determined position always, then you're going to have to concede that quantum mechanics is not a complete theory of the universe. You're going to have to introduce some additional properties of the particle, some sort of hidden variable. So this is Einstein's proposal. And on the other hand, if you're going to assume that the measurement actually forces the particle to take on some position, so let's say it doesn't have a position, a well-defined position beforehand, but the measurement that you take forces to take on some sort of position, then you have to accept that quantum mechanics has these two really different evolution laws. So the first one, which applies in any case where you are not making a measurement, it says that quantum states evolve according to Schrödinger's equation under unitary evolution. And then, so this happens most of the time, but then when you make a measurement, you've got this completely different law of evolution, which says that the wave function collapses to a particular point. And this is a very non-unitary, non-reversible process. So both of those two things are kind of weird. And if you find this interesting, don't despair, because even though we're not talking about it in this course, Joe Emerson's going to discuss it in the upcoming quantum theory course. Okay, so let's see if I can figure out how to work this thing. Seven?
That sounds expert at
Oh yeah.
Top left?
No,
Right
I'll just
left
use
or
the manual
bottom or
one.
top left?
Wait, 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 wait,
Top
wait.
left is the
Look at
one.
that.
The top row is the one that leaves the bottom element. They're not quite set the way I envisioned them.
Okay, that'll do. Alrighty. Okay, so now I want to talk about normalization of the wave function. So for the statistical interpretation of the wave function to make sense, we need psi to be normalized. So what I mean by that is that the integral over all space of mod squared of psi of x of t is equal to 1. So this means that the particle has to be somewhere, pretty much. And so if we look at the Schrödinger equation, which I didn't even write down. Okay. Well, let's write it down here. So if we look at the Schrödinger equation, which is essentially the quantum mechanical analog to Newton's law that we use to solve for the wave function of the particle, we see that if psi is a solution, then A of psi is also going to be a solution. So A is just some sort of complex number. And the process of normalization just means that we want to find out what this parameter A is so that the wave function is normalized. But it turns out that there are many solutions to the Schrödinger equation, some of which have a wave function where this thing, this integral is equal to infinity. There are also other solutions where Oh, actually, let's write this down. Some solutions. Then there are other solutions also where psi is equal to 0. And those solutions don't let you actually figure out what A is. And so these have to be rejected. They're not normalizable and they're physically unrealistic. And so the important point to remember is that only square integrable solutions to the Schrödinger equation are physically realizable. All the other ones are just rejected. Okay, so before I move on to momentum, are there any questions so far? All good. Excellent. Yeah, I'm going to have to figure out that other one soon. Okay, so now I want to talk about momentum and expectation values of operators. So, if we have a particle in the state psi, then the expectation value of the position is going to be given by the integral over all space of x times modulus squared of psi dx. Now, is that obvious to everyone? Like, is there anyone that this is not obvious to? Everyone's super smart. Okay. So if that's the expectation value of psi, what do we mean by this, expectation value of x? What do we mean by this expectation value? So it certainly doesn't mean that if I take a particle and measure its position and do this over and over and over again, the average of those values is going to be this expectation value. Instead, what it means is if I have an ensemble of particles and I prepare all of them in the state psi, and then take the average of those measurements, I'm going to get this expectation value. Okay, and as time goes on, we're going to have this expectation value change as a function of time. So we can write dx dt is d by dt of the wave function mod squared dx. And then this is going to be equal to so is that step obvious? Like, put your hand up if you think that step is obvious. Okay, you guys are like way smarter than me, because that's going to be a tutorial problem, and that wasn't obvious to me. There's quite a few steps you need to do. Anyway, so the tutorial is going to be easy for you, but for the other people, I don't think this should be obvious. So. For the moment, take it for granted, and then we'll work it out in the tutorial this afternoon. And then in the last step, using integration by parts, we're going to have something that looks like that. And so usually we're used to thinking about momentum in quantum mechanics rather than velocity, which is what I've written down here. So I'm just going to rewrite the expectation value of momentum. So P equals mv, so multiply this thing by m, and I get something that looks like that. And I can also rewrite the expectation value for x in a similar way. And what we see here is that these things are written in a very similar form, except this thing here can now be thought of as the momentum operator, because the expectation value of x is given by x sandwiched between psi star and psi integrated over dx. And then this operator, in the same way, sandwiched between psi star and psi integrating over dx, gives you the momentum. Yes? Correct. Good spot. So I think this is a nice intuitive demonstration of where the momentum operator comes from. And so a whole bunch of different dynamical variables can be expressed in terms of the position and momentum. And so if we have some sort of general property that we're interested in, let's say q, which is a function of x and p, then the expectation value of that analogously is going to be given by Q sandwiched in between psi star, where we replace X with the moment, P with the momentum operator. And then we integrate. Yes?
One thing, just you begin with the derivative of the expectation value of X, and you end with something that you call the expectation value of momentum.
Yep.
That's assuming that the expectation values must follow classical mechanics.
Yeah. So this thing here is the velocity of the expectation value, not the expectation value of the velocity.
Right.
And so I'm not being mathematically rigorous. I'm just trying to give an intuitive motivation for the momentum operator. Now, so it's possible to do this differently and define a wave function for velocity, but we're not going to do this in the course. So in the end, it works out the same way, but I thought this way was more instructive. But it's a good point that you raise. Okay, so any dynamical variable that we're interested in calculating can be figured out like this. And just quickly to give you an example, for kinetic energy, expectation value of T is going to be minus h bar squared on 2m. D squared psi dx squared times dx. And just for completeness, I want to derive very briefly the commutative between x and p. So the commutator for x and p is equal to xp minus px, which is going to be equal to x ddx minus dx dx, which is 0 minus 1, and then we get the familiar IH bar. And so the fact that this thing is not 0 means that X and P don't commute. They are complementary observables, which means that we can't measure both of them with arbitrary accuracy. Okay, so for the rest of the lecture, we're going to look at the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and we're going to find the stationary solutions as well as the general solutions to a bunch of different toy models. So no questions, no more questions at this point. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the properties of psi at the beginning of the lecture, but now we'd just like to find out how do we get psi. And the way that we do this is we solve the Schrödinger equation. So first, we can just write down the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which is, again, which in general is quite tricky to solve, but given that V, if V is a time-independent potential, then we can use separation of variables to at least find the stationary solutions. So we write the general psi, which is a function of X and T, into a function of x times a function of t, so lowercase psi of x and phi of t. And then this gives the Schrodinger equation like this. So now we've got all of the time dependence on one side and all of the spatial dependence on the other side. And so the only way that this equality can be true is if both of these things are constant. So I'm going to say that both of them are equal to a separation constant, which probably for obvious reasons I'm going to call E. And so now this gives us two sets of equations, or two equations. One of them is a very simple one, which is just d phi dt is equal to minus I on h bar e phi, which is easy to solve, just multiply everything by dt and integrate. And then we get that phi of t is equal to e to the minus I on h bar et. So that's kind of the trivial time dependence. And then the second equation that we get is and this thing here is what's known as the time-independent Schrodinger equation. So now it's just a matter of solving this time-independent equation. And if we do this, we're not going to get the general solutions to the Schrodinger equation. But these solutions are important nonetheless. They're important for three reasons. So one of them is that these solutions are the stationary states. What this means is they don't change as a function of time. You were the expert? Yes? No? What button do I, if I want to do it automatically?
If you can, you can also go to scroll and just do move the boards one by one.
No, but I don't want to do that. I want to. So I want to move mid.
Left, right at the bottom left.
Wait. All right. Yeah. We're making progress. Okay. Right, so the solutions to the equation after we use the separation of variables technique are going to be these stationary solutions. So even though the actual wave function, psi of x of t, which has this time dependence here, even though this thing is going to change as a function of t, if we look at the probability, distribution of so this thing modulus squared, the phases are going to cancel out, and so these states are going to be independent of time. And this happens also when we're calculating expectation values, because you always have a wave function from one side and its complex conjugate from the other side, so the phases all cancel out. The other important thing is that these states are states of definite energy, so they've got a well-defined precise energy. And also, probably most importantly, at least from a practical perspective, is that the general solutions to the Schrodinger equation can be written as a linear combination of these stationary solutions.
Thank you, real quick. So
yep.
We said that the wave functions have to be in L2, but phi isn't in L2?
I don't know what
that means. Right, like, what's the norm of phi? How do we normalize the phis? Is when we get infinite norm,
you normalize.
So only if the functions are square integrable, then you...
the bit size is square integrable.
Which one is not...
So you... I mean, you start off with some sort of unnormalized wave function.
The bit size of X and T.
And then to normalize it, you want this to be true. So you can solve for A. And you'll get A up to some phase that you're not interested in. Yeah, so this was the whole point before, that there are going to be some solutions to the Schrodinger equation where you can't do this. You can't figure out what A is. And those just have to be disregarded because they're unphysical.
But, for example, when one takes plane waves, which
mm-hmm.
are solutions to some of this problem,
mm-hmm.
They are not square integral,
yep.
although they have physical meaning, right?
So, well, I mean, we'll come to this at the end of the lecture. I'll do three examples, and the third example is going to be the free particle, and we'll get exactly those solutions.
And what sort of boundary conditions you have, right?
Right, so for the free part, I mean, we'll come to it, but for the free particle, you don't have boundary conditions,
yeah.
and you find the stationary solutions are these plane waves, but in fact, they're not physically realizable. They actually have consequences
okay.
on, you know, the physical state of a particle that has no boundary conditions. Yep. But we'll see that they're useful regardless of that. Okay, so the general solution to the Schrodinger equation can be written as a linear combination of the stationary solutions. So so if you actually want to solve this equation, you're going to need to specify the Hamiltonian, or in this case, at least the potential. And for your particular problem, you're going to need to specify boundary conditions and initial conditions as well. But we're going to do this now for three toy models. And the three models we're going to consider is the infinite square well, the harmonic oscillator, and the free particle, which I just brought up. And so I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritties because I'm certain you guys have seen all of this before, but I'll just show you how to construct the problem and sketch out how to solve it.
The one to the right, the one you
play. Thank you. So you pass already. Okay, so first toy models. What time am I finishing at? 11:45. Okay, I think we're doing well. Okay, so the first toy model is the famous particle in a box problem. So the potential for this guy is given by, but it's zero if x is between zero and point A, and it's infinity otherwise. And so we can draw this potential. So it's zero in the middle and then just infinity everywhere else. Okay, and so outside of the well, because this potential is infinite, psi of x is going to be equal to zero. And inside the well, the potential is zero, so the time-independent Schrodinger equation is very simple. Just looks like. Okay, and we also have some boundary conditions. So for the wave function psi to be continuous, we require that that psi of 0 is equal to psi of a is equal to 0. And so now if we use these boundary conditions and solve this differential equation, we get a series of multiple distinct solutions. And these are just sinusoids with different frequencies as a function of x. And each of these wave functions is, yes?
You're only choosing positive quantum numbers. Why do we leave out the negative quantum numbers?
Because sine of x is equal to sine of minus x.
Pardon?
The norm square is the same thing, so they're the same function.
Just if, yeah, it's a probability density, but in terms of the propagation of the particle, it would imply a different direction for propagation, would it not?
Well, no, here, if you
put
in minus
wave,
n, it's just the same. Minus n is the same solution as plus n, because sine...
They're not linearly independent.
Huh?
They're not, those two...
They're not linearly independent, that's why, right?
You
can leave those out, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, they're not linearly independent. I thought you were saying they're not linearly dependent. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay, and each one of these wave functions is going to have its own energy given by E of n, n squared pi squared h bar squared onto ma squared. And that's also for the same integer n's. And so this is... very different to what you would expect in classical mechanics, where the particle can take on any energy. Here, we only the particle can take on only these special discrete energies. So these wave functions have some interesting properties, which I guess I'll write down here. Okay, solutions to particle in a box. Interesting properties. So the first one is that they're alternatively even and odd functions. So as you go up in n, it's going to swap from being odd to even. And this isn't just a property of the particle in a box problem, but it's in general true for all even potentials. So alternate. Even and odd. As you go up in energy, each successive wave function is going to have an additional node, and this is in general true for all potentials. So up in energy, we add an extra node. They're also mutually orthogonal. Which tends to be generally true for most potentials, and they are complete. Which also tends to be true for all physically realizable potentials. And so what I mean by complete is that any wave function can be written down as a linear superposition of these solutions. Okay, and we can use this set of solutions to write down the general solution to the Schrodinger equation for the particle in a box. So here we've written down what that would be for an arbitrary n. So for the particle in a box problem, we would get bunch of stuff in the middle. Okay. So this is interesting because you can see that even though the stationary solutions themselves don't change as a function of time, when you start adding all of these sine waves with different phases, then as time goes on, you're going to be getting a wave function that definitely changes, a probability distribution that definitely changes as a function of time. So I lost my other board. Okay, so just to show you what these solutions would look like, they're just essentially what you would get on a guitar string. So the first one's going to look something like this. The second one is like that. The third one looks like that. And you can see that as we're going up in energy, we're adding extra nodes. And so just to emphasize this point of the fact that the probability distribution changes for superpositions of different states, if let's say I took a superposition of the first one and the second one, and let's say in this case the phase is zero, then I would get something that kind of looks like that. And so then the probability is going to be proportional to that. And then as time goes on, the phase with which I'm adding these two things changes. And so as it changes, this thing, when you add it with a different phase, you're going to get destructive and constructive interference in different sections. And so this, let's say, wave packet is going to slosh back and forth as a function of time. Okay, so the second toy model I wanted to talk about is the harmonic oscillator. And it's only a little bit more complicated than the particle in a box, but I think it's a lot more important because pretty much any physical potential can be locally approximated as a harmonic oscillator. And so this makes it an actually useful technique in practice, a useful toy model in practice. So let's say I have some sort of complicated potential that can look something, you know, like this. Then locally around this position here, I can approximate that as a parabola. Okay, so the potential for the harmonic oscillator is given as Vx equals half kx squared. This is supposed to be a proportionality constant. And so then the Schrodinger equation that we want to solve in general looks like this. Where the Hamiltonian is given by 1 on 2m p squared plus m omega all squared. And omega is related to the mass, and it's constant k. Okay, so we're going to use a nice algebraic technique to solve this problem. The approach is to try and factor the Hamiltonian. And so if these were just complex numbers, it would be really easy. So for C numbers, if you had something like, you know, u squared plus v squared, you could just decompose this into iu plus v times minus iu plus v, and you'd be done. In this case, we're dealing with operators, so it's a little bit more complicated, but looking at something like this inspires us to define some new operators which take on this form. And so I'm going to call these operators A plus or minus. And you can see analogous to that, they're going to take the form minus plus ip plus m omega x. And then we're going to put some sort of constant at the front just because it makes things look nice at the end. Okay. And we can see here that we're interested in finding products of things that look like that. So just to begin with, let's calculate the product of A plus and A minus. And if you go through all of the algebra, you see that it looks something like this. So you've got the Hamiltonian that you were interested in getting in the first place, and then you've got this additional constant. And this constant comes from the fact that these operators don't commute. And so now, since we're interested in the Hamiltonian in the first place, we can rearrange this to get the very familiar Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator. Which looks like that. So I should have one more ball here, no? Anyway, okay,
no,
we can
I didn't
erase.
Make that. This thing.
There's one like behind all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll come back here in my own time and figure out how these boards work. Okay. Right. So having the Hamiltonian in this nice form in terms of these operators that I just defined, we can calculate a new eigenvalue equation. So the Hamiltonian times the operator acting on some eigenstate, acting on the state, is equal to E plus or minus H bar omega. And so we already know that that psi is going to be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with eigenvalue E. And so if we know what psi is, we can just get to all of the other eigenstates with energy that are either higher or lower by H bar omega than E, simply by acting these operators A plus and A minus on the state. And so that's a very nice technique for figuring out what these eigenstates are. And so these operators are called ladder operators because they let you go up and down the energy ladder. In particular, A plus is called the raising operator, and A minus is called the lowering operator. And these are analogous to the creation and annihilation operators that we have in quantum field theory and in quantum optics, except subtly they're different because in that case they're changing the energy by adding and subtracting particles from the states, hence creation and annihilation. And I wasn't sure if I'm going to tell this joke. It's probably not funny, but I thought it was funny when I heard it. So John Sipe, a colleague of mine who's a little bit older than me, was commenting on the differences in terminology between lowering and raising operators and creation and annihilation operators. And then he said in the 60s they used to call them uppers and downers. Yeah, one laugh.
Why was that funny?
Why is it funny? uppers and... No. Someone maybe explain it later.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not explaining it. We can do that in the tutorial. okay, where was I? Okay, right. So given one psi, we can calculate what all the other psis are. So we just our task is to just figure out what one of them is. And so in the harmonic oscillator, it turns out that there's one lowest rung on this ladder where if you act the annihilation operator on that, it's going to go to zero. So we're going to call this psi of zero, this wave function psi of zero, and we're going to say that if we act a lowering operator on that, it's going to be equal to zero. And so now using the definition of A minus, which is over there, we can write an equation like this. And then it's just a matter of solving this differential equation for size zero. And the reason this is a differential equation, of course, is because P is defined in terms of the derivative with respect to X. Okay, so if we solve this equation, we get the following solution. That has energy of half h bar omega. And so this is the lowest energy that you can get for a harmonic oscillator, the ground state energy. And so now we can construct all other solutions just by acting the creation operator on this initial state, psi zero. So we add the raising operator n times on psi zero with an appropriate normalization constant at the front. And then this thing is explicitly written down in terms of these Hermite polynomials. So where these guys are Hermite polynomials. And so you can see we've got a Gaussian as a function of x multiplied by these polynomials and then a bunch of factors out the front. So let me just draw them for you. Yes?
What is the argument to say that there's a psi zero such that a with minus annihilates it?
Because eventually you'd get to negative infinity energy if there wasn't one like that.
Yeah, but just by looking at the Hamiltonian, how do you know that your energy has to be positive?
That's a physical condition we're imposing on our system. Energies cannot be negative.
No, not necessarily.
In our case,
also,
in this system.
It's a proof by construction, like you found it. Just plug in psi zero and you know that.
Yeah, so the deeper answer to this is not obvious to me at the moment, but we can come back to it later as well.
Yeah,
just remind me at the end
that
I want to find this out. But it's a very good question. So let's just draw these guys. So this is the potential. Just to guide the eye. And so the first solution is going to be this little Gaussian. And then the second solution, we add an extra node. Third solution has two nodes and, you know, so on. They're not very pretty, but you get the idea. So you can see that this has similar properties to the particle in a box, that they alternate between being odd and even, and we add successive nodes as they go on. But unlike the infinite well, some of the particle, the probability of finding a particle actually seeps out over to where, over past the potential. Okay, and just to finish off, I'll very briefly show you the free particle, which in principle should be the easiest one of all because there are no boundary conditions, but there are some subtleties associated with it. And Andres actually brought these up earlier. So again, we have the same Schrodinger equation as we did for inside the particle in a box. Except now things are simpler because we don't have these boundary conditions that we had before. So if we include the standard time dependence, then the general, not the general, but the time dependent solution is going to be given by... psi of x of t is equal to a normalization constant times I of kx and some other stuff. And so you can see this is where we run into problems now because we need this wave function to be normalized. And if we follow the standard procedure for determining what the normalization constant is, we find that this integral goes to infinity. So I'll just show you that. So the normalization condition requires that this integral is equal to 1 So if we insert... if we insert this expression for psi of x in here, we get we can pull a out the front, and the phases cancel out, and we get something like that, which is going to be, you know, to the constant times infinity. So we can't solve for a, and so this means that the stationary solutions to the particle in a box problem are not physically realizable solutions because they're not square integrable. And so this has some physical consequences. It means that a free particle can never be in a stationary state. And so there's no such thing as a free particle with a definite energy. But fortunately, we can still use these solutions to the Schrodinger the solutions for the stationary states for the free particle. We can use them to construct physically realizable solutions. And we do this in the same way as before, where we just take linear combinations of the stationary solutions. So,
question.
Yes.
Why do you say free particles can't have a, you know, state of
definite energy? So because the stationary solutions are the things that correspond to a state of definite energy. And here we see that the stationary solutions are not physically realizable because they're not square integrable.
But isn't this like a momentum eigenstate? So what I'm asking is this psi is an eigenstate of momentum, therefore
it's an eigenstate of momentum. But it's an interesting discussion, and we'll, like, I do have this on the tutorial as well, so we can talk about it then. So yeah, I don't know. I actually don't know how the tutorials have been run by the other classes, but by the other tutors. But I kind of wanted to split them up into maybe like three quarters where you guys answer questions like in the standard way. And then I wanted to have the last part, which is more of a general discussion of interesting concepts. And so this particular question is in that section. So we can continue the discussion later today, if you like. Yep.
One can it overcome this problem of having the plane waves that cannot be normalized by considering a finite volume?
Right, but then it's not a free particle anymore because then you've got some sort of boundary conditions. It's like a particle in a box.
Take a finite volume and the limit that it goes
to. Right. And,
but you still have the problem because your normalization will depend on the volume.
Yep. Right, okay, so yeah. Even though these are not physically realizable, we can still construct physically realizable solutions in the same way where we take linear combinations of these solutions. But I just wanted to say, to write this down, not physical. And so now we see that rather than just taking a sum over discrete states, we're integrating over infinitesimally states with infinitesimally small k's, narrow k's, so the plane waves. And so now, at least for appropriate choices of phi of k, this thing is square normalizable and a physical solution. And so this thing here, 5k, is known as a wave packet.
Sorry, what choices are phi of k?
Sensible choices.
Okay.
So you could imagine choosing phi to be a constant of k, and it goes on forever, and then you have a similar problem that you had before. Because you'll run into having to do an integral over all space times of a constant. Yes.
What's the energy in terms of k?
Pardon me?
What's the energy in terms of k?
H bar omega, where omega is related to k by whatever I wrote down somewhere. No, it'll be more complicated because it's not a photon. No, I don't know off the top of my head. Oh, hang on a sec. No, I have the energies. Yeah, I didn't write down the energies, but yeah, no, that's a... Okay. So what was it? H bar what?
K squared by 2.
K squared by 2.
Squared k squared.
H squared k squared over 2m.
Yeah.
You can set h bar to 1 m2.
But we're not doing that.
Set 2 to 1.
But that means I must have a typo somewhere else.
No, because it's
are you sure that's an h? Oh yeah, because it's h bar omega. Yeah, of course. Yep. Great. So 5k is the wave packet, and this allows us to take on physically normalizable states. But keep in mind now that there's going to be some sort of distribution of k, so there's not going to be a well-defined energy or velocity for this particle. And so that's pretty much all I wanted to talk about today. In the next lecture, we're going to continue with the Schrodinger equation, but we're going to extend it to three dimensions. So we'll look at the hydrogen atom, and we'll also look at eigenstates of the the angular momentum operator. Are there any questions at all? Okay, so you've got like 7 minutes early. And I guess I'll see you guys at the tutorial then. Thanks.